So again, this is just for illustration to show you that the language of field theory naturally arises in many different contexts, and particular in the cases where we need to deal with a system that has a large number of degrees of freedom, that are all important and are strongly coupled with one another. And then the description in terms of fields is naturally arises. So the problem that we are going to study is a vibrations of a problem of vibrations of a crystal lattice. So we'll consider a collection of atoms that form a crystal, and then we'll consider small deviations of from the equilibrium. So first of all, why? There's a very simple physical explanation why crystals exist. So potential energy of interaction between two atoms has the following shape. So this is a van der Waals potential. So it decreases at large distances as some power, and then so at large distances atoms attract one another. This is because what happens is that their electronic clouds polarize in such a way that they become dipoles. And so this dipole, so they orient each other in such a way that there is a feeble attraction between dipoles. And these dipole forces lead to the attraction at large distances. So atoms tend to decrease the energy by approaching one another. Now, of course, they have some typical size, so you cannot smash two atoms on one another. It's possible, but it costs energy. So there is a certain distance where attraction is changes to repulsion. So in the middle, there is a point where the potential has a minimum. So two atoms will minimize their energy by being at a distance, say, from one another. If you consider an array of atoms, then they will try to minimize their interaction energy by being order of a distance from one another, and the crystal lattices are just configurations that minimize the potential energy. So the typical lattice spacing is of order of this distance a that minimizes the van der Waals forces. So we'll consider very, very simple model of a crystal. My goal is not to teach a course in crystallography, so I'll simplify as much as possible. So we'll consider one-dimensional array of atoms. That interact pairwise, so there are only interactions between nearest neighbors. The Hamiltonian then is written as a sum over all atoms. Then each atom has some mass and has a kinetic energy. And then there is a potential of interaction between nearest neighbors. So Q's are coordinates of atoms. One-dimensional. So this is the Hamiltonian. And the potential has some sort of this shape. So in the minimum, classically, atoms will just arrange themselves into this periodic array such that the distance between them is A. So in equilibrium, Qn's are just equal to n times A. So we will study deviations from equilibrium. So we can write that Qn is n A plus Un. And we will assume that this the deviations from equilibrium are small. So Un is much smaller than A. So the atoms, each atom will be vibrate around its equilibrium position, but will not deviate much from, so the array will not be completely destroyed, but just each atom will vibrate and near its position of equilibrium. Okay, so mathematically this means that we can just Taylor expand this potential, so the linear term will vanish because the atoms are in equilibrium at these positions. And then we're going to keep the quadratic term. So let me give you the result of this little calculation. So we can write the Hamiltonian as pn squared over 2m. Nothing happens to this term. And then the next term will be quadratic in the deviation of positions of atoms. So here introduced some notations. So this letter CS squared, roughly speaking, determines how rigid is the array of atoms. So it depends on the curvature of the potential at the minimum. So if it's big, then, I mean, if the potential is very curved, then the atoms will, it will cost a lot of energy to fluctuate. And if it's shallow, then this is small, and then CS will be small. The reason I introduced it that way is just a matter of later convenience. You will see that this is a natural parameter to introduce. And then what are we going to do? Well, so the system describes a set of coupled oscillators. So the atoms will vibrate in unison. So they will sort of kick each other, and there will be waves propagating through this lattice of F atoms. We will consider waves that have wavelengths much larger than A. So we will take the limit where A goes to zero compared to all other parameters. And then what happens is that U that describe deviations of atoms from equilibrium, they change very slowly with n. And so we can introduce some interpolating functions. Which we call, well, P of x that is defined as 1 over square root of A M Pn and U of N A is defined as square root M divided by A U N. Then so we'll call N A denoted as a variable x, and we assume that these functions are, yes?
How come the interpolating functions have those forms?
This is just a definition. So are you asking about these factors in front? Well, it's just for convenience. This just tells us that the dependence on n is very slowly varying. So we can neglect the discreteness of this system and describe them by continuous functions. So we say the momenta of atoms will change slowly. So if this is P and this is N, we just draw the enveloping curve, and so this will be our P of X. So this just tells us that there are no abrupt jumps in this curve. So, and or in other words, the wave that propagates through this lattice has a very, very long wavelength. So the function changes on the distance is much, much larger than the separation between atoms. So then, instead of summation over n, we'll use integrals over x. And also, we can replace the derivative, so the difference by derivative. And then you understand, well, it is now clear why we introduced these factors of a squared here. It appears here, and it is makes it is such that it makes this whole combination finite in the limit where a goes to 0. So finally, what we get is the following Hamiltonian. And so, well, it describes some dynamical system that we're going to study. So in principle, P and X, originally, we can think of them as operators. So if we want to study the quantum mechanics of these lattice vibrations, then P of X are canonical variables that satisfy the canonical commutation relations. Where instead of the Kronecker delta, we have the delta function. So knowing this commutation relations and having the Hamiltonian, in principle, we can diagonalize it. But before doing this quantum computation, let us study this as a classical dynamical system. So when we have a Hamiltonian, then the canonical variables satisfy the usual Hamilton equations of motion. So du over dt should be equal to dh over dp. And dp over dt is minus dh over du. Okay, this was in the case where u and p were, say, numbers, but now they are functions. So the way to understand these equations is to treat this the coordinate x as a label. So it's like an index n for atoms. So it, actually, it's literally the index n. We just made an approximation when we took this interpolating function, but originally they were labeled by some index, the variables. So we should accordingly understand these equations. And well, the derivatives here then has to be understood in some way. And what they are is they are the variational derivatives in TNU. I don't know, did you have some variational calculus here in the URI? So you, I shouldn't explain what the variational derivative is. Very good. So so this is, well, delta H of delta P, and this is minus delta H over delta U. So let's calculate what is what are these derivatives. For that, we should take a variation of the Hamiltonian, and the linear terms in the variation of P and U will be the derivatives. So the first term is easy to vary. It just gives P delta P with a coefficient 2 that cancels these two. And the second term we need to integrate by parts. So we'll have delta U, and then d2u over dx squared. So the minus arises because we integrated by parts. And so we conclude that delta H over delta P is P, and delta H over delta U is minus the second derivative of U. So we can immediately write these equations. So du over dt is then p, and then dp over dt is cs squared d2u over dx squared. So then we can exclude p by differentiating this equation in time. And what we get is the second order differential equation, which I'm sure you're familiar with. This is just the wave equation for waves propagating with the speed c. So this equation describes acoustic waves that propagate through the this one-dimensional crystal. And c is just the velocity of sound. Now, in a more realistic case, so very little changes except that notations become more complicated. So first of all, okay, so then the displacement vectors will become three-dimensional. So u will be a vector, not a scalar. Also, the acoustic waves may be anisotropic if the crystal is, original crystal is anisotropic. So the speed of sound in general is a tensor. Anyway, so we'll stick to this simpler case because we only need to this mostly for illustration. So what we want to do is we want to quantize this system. So we want to quantize the acoustic waves. And we have everything to do this because, well, there is a Hamiltonian and there are commutation relations. So we just need to find, well, the spectrum of this Hamiltonian. And there is a, well, a simple way to do it because you see the Hamiltonian, the original Hamiltonian was a set of harmonic oscillators, and harmonic oscillator can be solved by introducing ladder operators. Now here we have infinitely many harmonic oscillators that interact with each other, but that's not really a problem because we can disentangle these interactions by going to the momentum space. So if you Fourier transform in X, then, well, derivative becomes just the momentum squared, not this momentum, but the momentum conjugate to X. And so we'll have a set of oscillators. So in momentum space, this will be just literally a set of harmonic oscillators. And we know how to quantize each oscillator. So at the end, we just need to introduce a set of ladder operators. And let me write down the answer. So the Hamiltonian can be diagonalized by introducing the following ladder operators. So they will be Fourier transforms of P and U. And so the point of, the calculation consists in just computing the coefficients. Okay, so then one can check that these ladder operators indeed satisfy the right commutation relations. And that remains to express the Hamiltonian. Yes?
I'm looking to become better acquainted with how one can use Fourier transform as a tool. How do we know that in this case the Fourier transform will uncouple the oscillators? Did just someone try it and it turned out to work? Or is there something about the problem that enables us to see a Fourier transform would uncouple a problem?
Because Fourier transform solves this equation. So the way to solve the wave equation is by Fourier transform. This is the easiest way to do it. So this then becomes an algebraic equation. Omega squared minus C squared times K squared acting on U is zero. So since the classical problem is solved by Fourier transform, you just try it for the quantum problem and it works. So it's the way was figured out. So you see that A and A dagger are sort of functions of U and P. One can invert these expressions, substitute them into the Hamiltonian, and this will be your exercise for the tutorial. But I'll write the result. So the Hamiltonian expressed in terms of A in A dagger has this form. And well, it is more or less what we got for particles in the second quantized representation, except that there we only had this term. Right? But this term can be brought to this form if we use the commutation relations. So we can equally well write this Hamiltonian as integral over k dk over 2 pi h bar times h bar cs absolute value of momentum times a k dagger ak and plus something that we interpret as vacuum energy. So this is just a constant. Which is equal to so here is this constant. So let's see. So what we need to do is we need to interchange the order of this two operators using the commutation relations. But you see that their momenta are the same. So the argument of the delta function on the right-hand side will be zero. So let's just leave it aside for a moment and look at this expression and see what it means. Well, from what we know about particles, we should interpret this Hamiltonian as describing a set of particles which are bosons, since their creation and annihilation operators satisfy the commutation relations. So this we should interpret as energy of the particle. And so the conclusion is that upon quantization, acoustic waves behave as particles, where the energy of the particle is linear in its momentum. So the momentum is equal, momentum of a wave is equal to h bar times its wave number. So the energy is equal to the speed of sound times the epsilon times the absolute value of the momentum. So this is the dispersion relation of of phonons. So it describes particles with the energy that depends linearly on the moment. So now what happened is that, I mean, this is of course a very simple calculation, but the physics behind it is kind of interesting because we started with a system of atoms that were interacting between one another rather strongly. So the interactions are such that they're kept fixed, or more or less fixed at certain positions. The potential, as you see, can become very large if they approach one another. And in fact, somewhere in the calculation, we assume that the depth of this potential is big compared to any other scale in the problem. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to use the approximation that the displacement vector, displacements of the atoms are small. Okay, so we started with a system where interactions are very strong. But then by identifying the right degrees of freedom, we reduced the problem to a set of emergent particles, phonons, that do not interact at all. So these particles, as you see, their Hamiltonian doesn't contain an interaction term. Of course, this is, we made some approximations on the way. At the end, we reduced the, so identifying the right set of degrees of freedom, we reduced the complicated problem with strong interactions to the problem without interactions at all. So the particles that arise here, they are not real particles in the classical sense of the word, because each phonon corresponds to the vibrations of all atoms in the chain, right? So you cannot identify one atom that corresponds to one particular phonon. So phonon is a wave that propagates through the whole lattice. So all the atoms will vibrate, and so this is a collective. It's a collective description of the in terms of the original degrees of freedom. Now let me return to this formula. So from one, I mean, this formula is definitely ill-defined. So you see that the it has a form of one infinity times another infinity. So this delta of zero is infinite. And then this integral diverges. We should take it from minus to plus infinity, and it diverges quadratically. So it apparently it doesn't make any sense. So one way to view this apparent problem is just to ignore it, because you see this energy appears as a constant in the as a constant shift of the it's the ground state energy of the system. We have some levels that we may or may not feel. So this is the ground state with no particles. Then we can add the phonon. Or two phonons. And then there are levels that correspond to phonons with different momentum. Okay. And so the excited states correspond to some non-zero occupation numbers of these levels. So the energy of this empty state is. Is this divergent expression, is this divergent integral. But after all, we are mostly interested in the increments of energy when we excite particular phonon states. So only the differences in energy make physical sense. And we can, measure all energies relative to the ground state. Okay, so then we just forget about this constant and don't care that it's divergent or not. But on the other hand, just from the formal point of view, we started with the expression that was well-defined, right? So the Hamiltonian, suppose that we considered Hamiltonian over there with, 125 atoms with some given potential, then certainly its ground state energy couldn't possibly be infinite, right? So the result of that we got here, so the infinities that we get here is a result of some approximations that, are not really justified, right? So if we get an infinite result, then we made some step where we should have been more careful. So let me, let us see what really this, how these infinities arise. So the reason that I want to do this exercise is that later, when we'll study relativistic field theories, infinities will appear all the time. And it's important to understand that there is nothing wrong with that, and there is some underlying physical reasons for them. And in most cases, we can just ignore their presence, in this case, where we simply may measure our ranges relative to the ground state. But anyway, so let's see why these infinities arise. So first of all, what means that we have delta of zero? Okay, so delta function, there is a representation for the delta function. So delta of k can be written as the Fourier integral of dx to 2 pi delta of k is this integral, right? It's a Fourier transform of 1. So when k goes to 0, what we get is just the integral of literally of 1. Then for this integral to make sense, we should remember that, for instance, that our chain was had finite size. So instead of considering an infinite chain of atoms, we could have considered a periodic chain. Of length L, so 2 pi delta of 0 then formally would be equal to integral from 0 to L of dx, which is just L. So delta of 0 is arose just because we forgot about the periodic boundary conditions on our atomic chain. If we were more careful, then instead of delta of 0, we would have obtained the length of the chain divided by 2 pi. Yes?
Right. Could you explain again what insights the integral representation of the delta function provides, and how we get from integral representation of the delta function to having forgotten about periodic boundary conditions, how all those ideas are?
Well, suppose that we start with this periodic chain. Then instead of Fourier integral, we would have Fourier sums. So then the variable k would have been discrete. So the allowed set of KLs would be equal to 2 pi L divided by L, and L would run from 0 to L minus 1. So in a sense, then instead of everywhere, instead of integrals, we would have sums over K in particular, and then in the formula for the commutation relations, instead of the delta function, we'll have Kronecker delta multiplied by L. So in the limit, that becomes the delta function. Except for the case where the momenta are literally equal to zero, and then, okay, instead of infinity, we would get L.
So was our unjustified approximation that the chain was infinite?
Yes. So we could have started with, honestly, we could have honestly done this calculation for a finite chain. And the problem wouldn't have arisen, but the only difference would be that delta of 0 would be replaced by L over 2 pi. Well, this was just a cheap way to see it. The delta functions arises, always arises Fourier transforms of the unity. Anyway, so what we get from here is that the vacuum energy is proportional to the length of the chain, which pretty much makes sense. So the vacuum energy is an extensive quantity. So it grows with the size of the system. And the quantity that is better defined is the vacuum energy density, which is the ratio of the vacuum energy to the length of the chain. And for that, we have an integral representation, which still is divergent. So this integral diverges large momentum. So let us make a very, very short break, just 2 minutes.